Yes. Okay. I think one thing that needs to be said at the outset is why mimesis as a focal topic for this. If you go back to the... this has a lot to do with the nature of the social sciences and the extent to which we're being reabsorbed into the biological sciences. I mean, I'm speaking from the standpoint... I'm assuming most people here are social scientists. Maybe not. I don't know. But if you go to the early history of sociology, the competing conception of what the social was basically a kind of aggregate of individuals that statistically moved in one way or another, and the way one would study social life would be looking at who the market leaders are, essentially, right? Who are the individuals that everybody else follows? And there's a name associated with that perspective, which is Gabriel Tarde, and he's come back into fashion. And one of the reasons why he's come back into fashion is a sort of growing skepticism with regard to macro-social entities, you know, like institutions, society as a whole, the state. And in a way, it reflects kind of the neoliberal times in which we live. And so this term mimesis, in a way, has a certain kind of salience, because the sort of strong sense of there being intrinsically social entities that are distinct from individual or biological entities, that's breaking down. So the salience of this concept of mimesis, where individuals are tracking under individuals, and that's how we explain social life, has sort of come back into vogue. Because this kind of concept has sort of been in and out for the last 150 years. We have things like contagion theory, for example, how rumors spread, right? It's the same way as how diseases spread. All this epidemiological stuff is very 19th century. Okay, but it's been revived with all the new science and everything training it. So there is a kind of interest. There are many different levels at which this concept matters. And it says something about the sort of changing relation, I think, between the social and the biological sciences. So that's one reason why we sort of fixate on it, even though maybe, you know, prima facie, it looks kind of strange. So, for example, you know, we have Richard Dawkins talking about memes, right? The spread of ideas, kind of on the model of spreading genes, where one asks things like, you know, sources, targets, vehicles of replication, right? We start conceptualizing, as it were, the transmission of social life very much in these terms, or thinking about ideas more generally as germs that spread. So the epidemiological models start to get treated in a way more and more literally, it seems. So we're basically responding to that as sort of general intellectual level. And as you can tell from the way that Dink was presenting the way we're going about business, it is exploratory in the sense that we're looking for projects that we can start exploring this in a sort of concrete way, and we're sort of fielding a lot of possibilities at the moment. So we've been inviting a very heterogeneous bunch of people to our workshops. As Nick pointed out, I gave a sort of opening lecture in June about the origin of this concept. And the origin of this concept really comes from the humanities. One can talk about what I talked about was a sort of a Greek and a Christian origin to the concept of mimesis. Where in the Greek sense of mimesis, where it was kind of the vehicle by which one reproduced something in the sense of making an artwork, right? Copying nature, right? There the issue was... you know, how can you tell the difference, and is there some sense in which one doesn't, you know, is there a problem if one doesn't recognize it as an imitation? You know, so in other words, and the way we might put this in terms of contemporary social science terms is, you know, you end up having these ideas or these behaviors, and you don't know where they come from, they just become part of you. Does that matter? Right, the way these things kind of spread without you actually having a say, but you just sort of accept them as natural. So there's that side of the mimesis issue. But then there's a sort of more positive side, which is associated with the Christian tradition, where one has a whole tradition of talking quite literally about imitating Christ. And what does that mean? Okay, does that mean, as it were, following the example of the person and living a Christ-like life, which may mean getting yourself crucified? Or does it mean following the words? Right, which then brings in the church and priests and in a way conducting yourself in a different kind of way, but nevertheless, you know, saying the same sorts of things. Okay, and so there is this issue that again rises, what is it that is being copied, that's being replicated, both at a behavioral, concrete standpoint, but also from a normative standpoint? What is it that we do want people to replicate, right? And so issues, you know, if one is thinking about from... because some of our colleagues, I mean, in particular, I guess, Ann Adams, thinking about it from the standpoint of interventions. You want people to change their lives and do something different, right? What is exact, you know, how does that process occur, where you want the mimesis to move in a different direction, okay? Nick brought up... the example, he alluded to one of the talks that took place in our workshop in October by Stephen Stack on the copycat suicides. This man spends his whole career doing this. One of the things that he points out is the role the media has in the presentation of these suicides of illustrious people, and basically the fact that the media stories tend to drag on forever, and they tend to sort of glamorize, often through with photographs and everything, the issue arises. Okay, that creates kind of, as it were, you might say, a sort of environment for susceptible individuals to respond to, because this stuff is repeatedly being presented to them in the media. Well, okay, what do we want to say about the individuals who respond to at least attempting suicide on the basis of this? Well, the traditional notion was that these teenagers were impulsive. They just see these things and they just... But there is a kind of deeper social analysis which has a lot to do with what exactly are these kids copying. And typically what he found out, what this guy Stack has found out, is that the kinds of teenagers who are most susceptible to this kind of copycat phenomena are ones who have weak social bonds, and so they're not really copying anyone else. Okay, poor family ties, whatever, right? In sociology we talk about anomie, right, where you're sort of rootless. And so this presentation, especially when it's presented in a kind of an attractive way, okay, then becomes something that these kids are effectively modeling. This is the theory that's being presented, that was presented to us, which we thought was kind of an interesting theory, because one of the things, so it shows, in a sense, the role of the media in presenting, a situation over and over again that triggers susceptible individuals, and the individuals are susceptible largely because they're not copying anything else. So in a sense, the suicide celebrity is a role model. Okay. So that was a very interesting kind of observation. That was something... And over and over again, we found that the media was playing a role in terms of laying out the conditions under which mimesis would occur. Okay, and so in fact, for our workshop in December, I have invited someone who's a social historian of advertising, because it seemed that that is kind of very crucial for understanding the environment under which mimesis occurs. Now, what is it about advertising? Well, advertising is different from, let's say, providing incentives for people to behave in a certain way. Because advertising taps into what people are already thinking, already doing, and then basically doing a kind of nudge thing. Right? The whole idea of nudge, right, is to basically take where people are already coming from, what they're already thinking, and moving them in a slightly different direction, without having to provide incentives or something that forces them to say, okay, I don't really want to do this, but if you pay me enough, I'll do it. You don't want them to get to think like that. You want them to just move in a sort of natural direction a certain way. And advertising taps into that. And from that standpoint, it can create these environments where behaviors can be reproduced by tapping into things that people are already latently in a position to do. Okay, so it happens in a very seamless kind of fashion. And again, if we're thinking about interventions, that's a kind of useful kind of process to study. Here I want to bring up one of our other workshop speakers from October, David Wooten, who's a historian of medicine. Okay, and he wrote a very interesting book called Bad Medicine. Okay, and the point of that book is that basically, if you want to explain the medical practice, pretty much up to the late 19th century, it was all through the placebo effect, because the stuff didn't really work, but people kind of kept on doing the treatments, nevertheless, because why exactly? Well, one of the answers that he comes up with in the book is that there's a certain kind of identification that the patient undergoes with the doctor, right? So it doesn't matter whether the doctor says, we're going to bleed you with leeches. That never works empirically, but nevertheless, the patient likes the doctor, identifies with the doctor, sees the doctor as a good person, sees the doctor, as someone they want to identify with. And that kind of identification with the medical doctor, regardless of what the doctor is doing, ends up leading to all these treatments. Now, one of the things that happens in the 19th century that changes all this isn't actually scientific in the strict sense, because the actual science of, you know, germs cause disease and stuff like that, that had already been floating around for a while, but didn't influence medicine. Right? Because medicine's not the same as biology. All right? Very important point. So the biology was already there, but the medicine hadn't changed. But what did change was you started getting people, as it were, organizing their experience differently and identifying with different things. And this comes about largely when people find themselves in hospitals. So they're no longer just directly relating to a particular medical doctor who they have a personal relationship and who they identify with, but rather now they're in these hospital wards where they're hearing all these stories from all these other patients about all these incompetent doctors that force them into the hospital ward. And so they start, as it were, identifying differently, right? They start identifying more readily with what we now call the medical statistics, okay? And so then people start taking that stuff seriously, you know, as to what works or doesn't work with regard to medicine. How many, you know, mortality rates, right? Things like that. Okay, so you get a different kind of self-identification going on as the environment in which medical practice is taking place is changing. Okay, and this happens in the second half of the 19th century. And then, you know, you think about this period, you have photographs of this, you can, you know, you have the tables, the charts, you know, all of this stuff. And then so people start to think about medicine differently, and they start to, in a sense, identify with the statistic, not with the doctor. You know, and that is a very interesting observation. And so Wooten, at the end of his talk, he was also pointing us in the direction of advertising. But how do people, what do they identify with? And that ends up moving them. Because he gave us example of again and again and again of practices that take place in the history of science that from a strictly scientific standpoint are false, and that from a conceptual standpoint should have been abandoned them. But the people who were practicing them were people that people identified with. So alchemists, astrologers, things like that. These were kind of celebrity characters. People kind of liked dealing with them. There was a kind of placebo effect going on. Okay? And so that's kind of a strand of something that I think we didn't anticipate, but I think is kind of coming out from these mimesis workshops. Then there's the issue of exactly how does one conceptualize. How much more time do I have? I don't want to.
You should finish now, but.
Okay.
5 minutes.
Okay.
We can stretch. Here's another 5 minutes.
Okay, as you can see, we got a lot of things that we need to pull together in some way. Let me bring up one, because this gets us back to the biosocial interface in a very direct way. We had a very interesting presentation at the workshop. Between a mathematical biologist, a guy named Matt Keeling, and one of our own co-eyes, Francis Griffiths, who's a health sociologist. And they're both talking about the epidemiology of disease and how they spread. And they both sort of accepted the idea that these things sort of spread in networks, and that maybe even a kind of small world analysis of networks might work in the sense that the diseases tend to spread very fast, within a particular network, but the network peters out after a while and the disease doesn't spread so much anymore. So there's a sort of, so the social network, the self-contained character of the social network confines the spread of the disease. Okay, fine. The interesting question, though, is what exactly is being tracked? Because there is a tendency that when the mathematical biologists track this stuff, they look at self-reporting of disease cases, and then they start counting them and aggregating them and all the rest of it. They don't really look at all the other forms of contact that are involved that could reinforce this or whatever. And interestingly, when the sociologists study these things, they tend to sort of study other different forms of contact. So you end up, as it were, getting parallel universes of the way in which these spreads are being tracked because of the different indicators that are being looked at. And the question is, well, can these indicators interact with each other in some sort of substantial way to present a kind of overall biosocial account of disease spread? And the thing that was very striking from the workshop was how difficult that was to get them to think about it on stage together. Even though we basically had a presentation where you had the one and the other, and then the question gets put to them, and it wasn't, and they kept on retreating to the disciplines. Okay? Now you see, the question of obesity is kind of interesting from this standpoint. This is one reason why I think obesity issue is kind of attractive to us, because it's going to be very hard to track this without mixing these things together. It's not just going to be enough about finding out how many overweight people there are in the country. Okay. And so that's one reason why we sort of stuck onto this. I should say, though, and I'll conclude on this, that when we had this open space stuff, where basically we're breaking up into small groups and we're sort of going through all the topics of the workshops in more detail, relating them to the particular expertises of the people, you know, from all these different fields have been showing up, we found a whole wide range of potential applications for this that went from, you know, issues like, you know, organizational change management to something like cross-cultural change management. So, for example, there's this very well-documented thing, at least in social psychology, about the difference between the Western and the Chinese mindset. Okay? And what's going to happen, you know, given the changing economic circumstances globally, right? I mean, is there going to be a, as it were, a spread of the Chinese mindset in some sense? And what would that mean exactly? And is that something to be managed or anticipated? You know, in other words, and people think that that, in fact, is an interesting sort of question that could be pursued. You know, in terms of just thinking about facilitating cross-cultural communication, but also the potential political consequences of this as well. But I'll stop there. But that's as far as we've got so far. Okay.
Thank you very much. So.